All right, so I think what's exciting about doing neuroscience is that it holds a promise of asking all the questions like what's consciousness, what's thought, what's self-awareness that philosophers have pondered for thousands of years, but also it has a promise of an ability to answer those questions on the level that is acceptable in physical sciences. And one central concept in all those interesting philosophical terms is persistence. Because if you think about it, none of this is possible if you cannot hold a percept of the world or your state in mind for some significant period of time. And what I want to talk about today is the neuronal correlate of persistency of percepts. So in terms of, in operational terms, the concept of persistency is often studied in a working memory task, and I'm sure many of you know, in that task, a monkey is asked to fixate on this cross, and while it's fixating, a target appears, and the monkey's job is to make a saccade to where the target was, even after the target disappeared. And so the saccade is only made after the cross goes away, after a delay period when the target is not there. So the monkey has to hold in its mind the location of the target to be able to successfully make a saccade towards where the target was. And after training, monkeys are extremely good at doing this task, and other animals can do something like that too. And so that suggests that there is indeed some persistent representation of the sensory stimulus in their brain. How is that representation maintained? Well, a standard explanation goes roughly like this. So there are neurons, and some of those neurons go on as the target goes on at this point in time, but then their firing rate does not go down after the extinction of the target, but it stays on throughout the delay period until the cue, which in this case is the disappearance of the cross, tells them to make a saccade towards remembered location, and at which point they perform the task. The key to this explanation is that information about the location of the target is maintained by the firing rate of neurons throughout the delay period. And of course, the explanation is supported by experimental evidence, starting with the work by Pfister, and here is an example from Patricia Goldman-Rakich, where a monkey was performing this task where it had to saccade to one of those eight locations, but after a delay period when the target was extinct, and throughout that delay period, neuronal firing rate was indeed elevated. This particular neuron had a rotation, had a preference towards saccades in the direction of 135 degrees and did not fire much to other directions, supporting this view of persistent activity being a neural correlate of working memory. If you have any questions, please feel free to interrupt. Well, so here, nothing tells you about the network. But there is a problem with this. I'll get to the problem in a moment. So then, this is an example of one neuron, and suppose it prefers one other orientation, but there are other neurons, and they can hold other projections of the saccade vector. And so, for example, in the case of a two-dimensional sensory stimulus, which has components S1 and S2, just like the projections of the saccade vector, you can use two neurons whose activities are A1 and A2, and they form an orthogonal basis, and then their activities encode the location of the target. And so just two neurons would be able to do this job, and there is no need for a network, and they just maintain that percept. But there is a problem. And the problem is actually has been known for a while, and it's the fact that when you actually record from those neurons, many of them don't hold their firing rate constant throughout the delay period. So just like in this example, which comes from the work of Brody and Roma, this is one of the many things that neurons do, and this one actually changes its firing rate non-monotonically throughout the delay period. In this case, the task was not to make a saccade, but to compare two vibrational frequencies applied to the monkey's finger. But the point is that most of the neurons from which Roma recorded did not hold firing rate invariant throughout the delay period. I don't know this particular trace, but they have done experiments both when animals knew and both when animals did not know. I'm sorry? I don't remember the statistics, but this is just one of the different non-constant trajectories that neurons have. And in fact, when this paper really brought attention to this issue, but it has kind of been known for a while. The majority of neurons that even Goldman-Rakic recorded from do not hold firing rate constant. It varies in time. Yes. And so the ones that, you know, that are usually shown are the ones that hold the firing rate, but this is small minority, by some estimates, 1% or less of neurons. So the majority of neurons are not holding their activity fixed. And that, of course, presents a big problem for this explanation, because if the activity of A1 changed, that means that the projection of the stimulus onto the x-axis changed, and that means the saccade was perceived to be in a different location, and that means that a monkey would make a wrong saccade. But we know that the monkey does the saccade correctly, and so we know that it somehow maintains the percept in face of changing neuronal activity. Well, that is a possible explanation indeed, but then the majority of neurons, what are they doing? They are participating. Well, but they're participating in the task. Their activity is, of course, task correlated, but it's not what you want it to be. Well, but the firing rates change differently in different neurons. It's not like the magnitude of the vector is changing, but the direction is the same. The vector is rotating around.
This explanation couldn't be right, though, because couldn't that make lesions in a particular area and find that they couldn't remember in that, they couldn't remember a motion of that thing, but they could still remember as the cause of other things? So that would suggest that there's a map someplace in the firing of cells in that location where both are wearing the map to look.
I think there is some topographic organization in the prefrontal cortex. That's
so
true.
So but if you just made a lesion there with this model, here you would be able to knock out motion to a particular place.
That's a good point. That's a good point. Yeah, that is actually kind of supportive of what I'm about to say. Thanks, yeah. Okay, so what's going on here? And there has been prior work departing from this experimental observation. Like there's a paper from Mark Goldman, and there is also work from Surya and Heimsen-Polinsky. And what I'm going to say does not contradict what they're saying, but we just use the same experimental motivation to propose different things. I think, in fact, they are compatible and could be realized in the same network. But the basic observation that I want to make is that the problem with this model arises because we're using an orthogonal basis, where the number of sensor dimensions, which is 2 in this case, is the same as the number of neurons, and the feature vectors of those neurons are orthogonal to each other. This is a natural way to approach the world if you're a physicist, but it turns out that we have to think in very different terms to understand biological networks. And the way we need to change our thinking is to realize that neural representations are almost always overcomplete or redundant by their nature. So, for example, very well-known fact from anatomy is that the number of neurons in the primary visual cortex is at least 100 times greater than the number of thalamic inputs from the LGN. And if you associate the number of neurons in the two corresponding areas with the number of dimensions, it means that the representation in the cortex is much higher dimensional than the sensor stimulus that it gets. Another evidence for this comes from actually mapping out receptive fields, say by reverse correlation, and you can see that the typical receptive fields of different neurons do not look like they form an orthogonal basis. So if you compute cross correlations of these receptive fields, you're not going to get zero. So that means that the neuronal representations are non-orthogonal, they don't form a basis, they form what is called a frame. Now, what I would like to do today is to talk about a cortical representation that maintains a persistent percept. But because it relies on this highly non-intuitive for a physicist concept of non-orthogonal frames, I want to first build up some intuition by considering a toy model. And once we are comfortable with the toy model, we'll go back to the cortex and solve it. Okay? So the toy model is what is called the Mercedes-Benz frame. And you will know why, because this is a frame that exists in a plane, so there are two sensor dimensions, but the feature vectors of this representation are oriented at 120 degrees to each other, A1, A2, and A3. So you use three numbers to encode location in a two-dimensional space. Then any vector, like the one corresponding to the point there, can be decomposed into the activities of neurons 1, 2, and 3. And so you can view it as a linear combination of the activity of first neurons times its feature vector, times the activity of the second neuron times its feature vector, and the third neuron. Okay? Of course, you can do this all with matrices and write down coefficients. I just thought that it would be easier to just draw the vectors. Now, because this is actually two equations, because they're S1 and S2 here, but three unknowns, A1 and A2 and A3, there are infinitely many solutions that give that represent the same percept. So for example, if you were looking at this vector that corresponds to S1 equals 0 and S2 equals 1, you can make it out of the first neuron's feature vector, not using the second and the third, or you could not use the first, but instead use the second and the third with negative coefficients. Well, you're not averaging, you're summing with the weights corresponding to activity. Okay? Now, if you're surprised by the negative numbers, don't worry about it. It's really not important. You can think that, you know, neurons at rest have non-zero firing rate, so it can go up or down, or you can introduce opponent on and off cells. That's not a big deal. The point is that these are two examples of how you can decompose that sensory percept in terms of neuronal activity. And these are just two out of the infinite number. Okay? So you can represent the same sensory percept by different sets of neuronal activity. Another way to visualize it is to actually go into the three-dimensional space of neuronal activity defined by those green vectors, and it's projected then on the sensory space, forming this Mercedes-Benz frame. And then if you think about this sensory location at S2 equals 1, S1 equals 0, then as long as the projection of the neuronal activity vector falls on that point, you still have the same percept. And any activity vector on that red line would, in fact, correspond to the same percept. So as I move along that line, distribution of activity among neuron changes, but the percept remains fixed. So in the end, it may be not so surprising that people see time-varying neuronal activity while holding the percept constant.
But they're all varying in the same way.
They vary in a correlated fashion, yes. No, you have all kinds of behaviors. You have ups and downs. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. This is just one neuron, and I, you know, if I did not crop this figure, there would be like a whole list of different other neuronal behaviors.
Yeah, I think you're overcompleting this
Yes. Well, I think you would have to record from more than one neuron to see that. I think that's a very good question, but I think I should be asking you that question.
So then the statement is if you were to look at the variability of the signal in the same state, your whatever principal component analysis would pick up a number of variable dimensions, and that number would basically be the number of zero modes.
So I think what you're asking is that if I'm an electrophysiologist and I recorded from many neurons at once, and then I threw that threw PCA on that data, would I recover this hidden sensory dimension?
Well, your most of the variability then should be associated with your zero model.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but so the problem with PCA is that how could you not find that, right? If you do PCA on that sort of data, you would always find some principal modes. How would you know these are the right principal modes? And in what Christian did, he actually took single neuron recordings from different experiments. And my intuition is that I think it's crucial to take recordings from the same experiment because the exact firing of individual neurons is not that invariant from experiment, from trial to trial. Well, that's what I'm saying. That's what PCA will always give you something, right? There's no way that it will fail. So it will always give you something. How would you know that's the thing that I'm talking about? Yes, exactly. Thank you.
So don't know if they do it, but you're not worried about that they might not. So I just don't understand why I should be worried about things changing and not the possibility that they might change in some particular projection which gives some readout. But I mean, you haven't had it.
I haven't.
I mean, you just said that there is a possibility to allow for redundancy, that things can change, but some particular projections don't change.
That's right. I, you know, depending on your point of view, you may argue that I haven't said anything new. At this point, I just wanted to emphasize that you have to start thinking differently in terms of, you know, when you deal with oral complete representations. I haven't told you the actual content of the talk yet. And in fact, frames have been around for us, with us for ages. You know, in engineering, as Clay pointed out, they're often used for noise-resistant communications, because if you encode in frames, noise can actually cancel out, and so on. So it's really a mathematical concept that has been around for a while. What I just wanted to emphasize that we really have to use this concept for neurons. But that's all. Okay? All right. So now that's just a mathematical concept. And I think there is no disagreement that if the activity vector stays on this line, which is orthogonal to the sensory subspace, then the percept will stay constant. But how can neurons assure that the activity vector will stay on that line? So for example, that suggestion of individual neurons just being bistable and, you know, not talking to each other would not produce this, because eventual activity in one neuron will decay, and that will be the death of the percept. Okay? So how can we build a network that maintains that persistent percept or keeps the activity vector on that one line in face of variability? So for example, if you think about graded neuronal activity, there is leakage, and the current decays, the current flows out, and so the neuronal, the membrane voltage decays with time, and that will presumably destroy the percept. How can we counteract that? And the suggestion is as follows. Just like we could represent any stimulus as a linear combination of feature vectors, we could represent each neuron's feature vector as a linear combination of other neurons' feature vectors. So in the Mercedes case, this vector is just minus the sum of those two. So if there was a way to activate those two neurons just enough to offset the loss of the percept in the activity of the first neuron, we would maintain the percept constant. In this particular case, we can do this by using the following circuit, where these are synaptic weights with synaptic connections with negative weights, and minus one here is, of course, because you have minus one in the linear decomposition. And so when the activity in this neuron is decaying, it's being compensated because it excites synaptic currents in those two neurons, which pick up collectively, they pick up the contribution of to the percept that is lost by the first neuron. Okay? Some linear combination.
It's almost the opposite in some models, which the connection between neurons is the dot product of the receptor field. This is essentially called the negative dot product.
Well, no, because the dot product here will actually be negative because it's 120 degrees. So the connections are not exactly the dot product, but it's you're thinking in the right direction.
Yeah,
That is true, yes. Oh, these are just linear neurons. So, you know, V dot is minus V plus the synaptic connectivity matrix times V. That's a good question. And in 10 minutes, I will show you that I can put in nonlinearity while still preserving this. Yes. Well, whether it's garbage, we can talk, but it's not relevant to the change. It's not changing the percent. Okay. So this is a strange network if you think about persistent activity, because this seem to be inhibitory neurons. But again, the inhibitory synapses, don't worry about that, because the reason that happened is that the vectors are oriented at 120 degrees. If I chose different vectors that would have smaller angles, then, you know, I would have positive weights. I have to say that I really need to study that paper more carefully. Okay, so this is the end of the toy model, and this is pretty much the gist of what I wanted to say. And in the rest of the talk, what I'm going to do is to apply what I said to the cortex and introduce the network that does the same job in the cortex, okay? And show that that network, in every aspect that we looked at, is exactly the same as what we know about the cortex. Yes. Yes. Absolutely. That's what we need. Okay? So are there any questions about this toy example? Is there any remaining confusion about it?
The one thing that still bothers me
Yes.
is I still remember where your spot was. I guess I just translated it into some other kind of memory.
Yeah, perhaps you have. Well, well, that's perhaps where LTP comes in, right? Yes. No, so this has two eigenvalues, okay? One is very negative, and I'm sorry, three eigenvalues, eigenvectors. One has very negative eigenvalue, and two have an eigenvalue. Okay, depending if you include that term, they will both be at zero. But if you don't include, they're both at one. I like to use the notation where it's an eigenvalue of L, so they're both at one. You do have persistence. So you can think of this as a line attractor. Yeah, this is like a line attractor with two dimensions. So it's an attractor plane. And if you sit in that plane, you don't go anywhere. And that's the general line attractor. But my main point is not what happens when you sit in that plane, because that's when the activity stays constant, but in your trajectory towards that plane. So what happens while you're approaching? So this is the plane of plane attractor. And if your activity vector is anywhere here, it doesn't go anywhere. It sits there. And that's the traditional persistent activity state, just like the one that is experimentally seen in the goldfish, but not in the cortex usually. Okay? So what my main attention is to how you approach that state. And if you approach it along the red line, then the percept remains constant, but the activity changes. Okay? So it's kind of a complementary thing to persistent activity. Exactly. But I have to say that this is just a toy example. In a bigger network, you have much more complex behavior. So you can have many modes, and if the matrix is not normal, you can have them go up and down. You can have all kinds of activity changes, but the percept will stay still. Oh, okay. Okay, great, thanks. All right?
So it doesn't matter where you are along this line, so nothing physical can fall through the analysis over time. You're saying that the dynamics of adaptation is going to move you through time and trajectory along.
Right, so that's the dynamics of the network that is going to move you along that line. Yeah, I mean, the end point, if you wait infinitely long time, you will end up on that plane, of course, and the neuronal activity will be constant after that. But that may happen after any sort of behavioral relevant time scale, and we could be living just in the transient state all the time. All right? So, of course, since we're going to talk about the cortex, it's no good just thinking about graded activity. We need to think about spikes. And this is basically the same idea. It's just when the membrane potential, which hypothetically encodes the percept, grows, this neuron contributes a lot to the percept, and then it reaches a spiking threshold, and the neuron resets to the resting potential, then this neuron's contribution to the percept is gone. But if you have a connectivity like this, that contribution is immediately picked up by other neurons that are postsynaptic to that neuron that received EPSPs from that neuron after the spike, and the amplitude of those EPSP has to be chosen exactly to recombine that neuron's feature vector. Then the percept will remain constant. Okay? So, in fact, that tells you that if you want to have a network that stores the percept for any amount of time, just how long it takes for any neuron to spike, it actually must have that property. Because if it didn't, after the first neuron spikes, the percept is distorted. And if other neurons spike, the percept is gone. So this could be a necessary condition for any network that could maintain something for even a very short period of time. Okay, now let's move to the visual cortex. And what I'm going to talk about is the primary visual cortex, and not because I think this is the main place where persistence activity exists, but because that's where we know something about the receptive fields, the feature vectors, the anatomical connectivity, and so on. And so I'll just use the primary visual cortex as a model for this theory. As I mentioned before, we assume that there are M dimensions in the cortical network, which is much greater than the number of sensory dimensions. And then, as you all know, you can represent any patch in the visual world, like this one, as a linear combination of individual neurons' feature vectors times their activity. Of course, I'm assuming that decoding is linear, but I don't think this is really crucial. It's just easier to think about it this way. So I can represent this patch as a linear combination of neuronal activity of, say, those neurons with receptive fields like this. But of course, because the representation is over complete, there are many more neurons than dimensions, I can choose a different set of neurons to represent exactly the same patch. And there are an infinite number of combinations of neurons which with different activity coefficients would give you the same patch. So now it's time to construct the network which will maintain the percept. And the way I will do it, just like in the Mercedes-Benz frame, I will, for each neuron, I will do exactly the same procedure. I will take that neuron's receptive field, and I decompose that receptive field in terms of other neurons' receptive fields. And I will find this, the coefficients beta that make sure that this equality holds. And then I assign synaptic weights on outgoing synaptic weights of that original neuron to be those coefficients beta. Yes. Yes. I'll tell you in 5 minutes. Yes. So, but let's assume we chose one setting and we assign synapses to be given by those betas, okay? Then what's going to happen to the percept? Suppose this neuron contributes with activity A4 to the percept here. And that representation, that activity, is stored its membrane potential, which will at some point approach the firing threshold, and after the spike, it will reset to zero, and A4 will become zero. But if I set up the connections this way, then the EPSPs produced by that spike will add to the membrane potential of these neurons exactly the right amount to maintain this neuron's contribution to the percept, which is this. And that's guaranteed by this equation. Okay? So this neuron, A4, was contributing something to the percept. Without it, the percept wouldn't be perfect. And then it fires and resets. Its contribution drops out. But it's immediately picked up by the postsynaptic neurons to those neurons, whose receptive fields, added with synaptic weight coefficients, make up the receptive field of that neuron. Well, this is not something I want to emphasize because I'm not sure it's completely crucial, but I am assuming here that the percept is stored in subthreshold potentials. Now, I know, because I felt the same way, that this seems counterintuitive, because how does the percept ever get out of the neuron if it's stored in a way that is not sensed by other neurons? But I think asking this question reveals a homunculus fallacy. And I did the same thing, so that's why I'm saying it. Because it's not like in the end there needs to be some entity that watches all the spikes and decides what they are. I think it is really true that the percept stays in V1. And only a very compressed version of the information in V1 makes it to V2. So it's not totally unacceptable that the percept is in membrane, stored in subthreshold potential. Okay? So when the neuron spikes, when the neuron spikes, its membrane potential resets to its resting value. Okay?
Couldn't you just have been represented as spike frequency?
You could. You could. I mean, in this equation, I can just have this to be a spike frequency. Sure, but I do think that this picture is more accurate. But you could, if you feel uncomfortable with using the... So you can, if it's easier for you, you can think of this as just firing frequency. Okay. All right. So as Srini pointed out, this representation. Oh, sorry. I just yeah. This representation of the neuron's receptive field is not unique, because again, the representation is overcomplete. It's a frame, and so there are many ways to decompose this neuronal receptive field into other neurons' receptive field with different coefficients, and perhaps even using different sets of neurons. And so we call all these different networks where you use different solutions for all these neurons a family of networks, and we call them refire networks for receptive field recombination networks. So all the networks for which postsynaptic weights for each neuron satisfy this condition are refire networks. And they will all maintain persistent percept for any activity vector.
So data is the puff, or data that give you the relationship between the receptive fields, or the bottom.
So, okay, so let me just say procedurally. You take a neuron's receptive field, you figure out how to represent it as a linear combination of other neurons' receptive fields, and then you appoint all the outgoing synaptic weights to be those coefficients.
Does it? That's a solution to that equation, and you're making a network that embodies that solution.
Yes. There are many of those solutions and many of those networks. They may or may not. No. Because there is non-unique decomposition, I can use, when I decompose this neuron, I can just ignore this neuron altogether. Could be static, yes.
So that means that if you represent your beta decomposition for the first neuron,
yeah,
then each one of those, beta 1 through 5, also has to be represented in terms of the fifth neuron.
Not in the overcomplete basis. So we have such an overcomplete basis, there are so many receptive fields, that none of them is truly replaceable. A neuron can die, we wouldn't even notice it, because there are neurons with feature vectors really close to it. And we can always come up with the different linear combinations, excluding individual neurons. But you would have to rewire. But I'm just giving it as an extreme example that it could be a symmetric network, but it doesn't have to be a symmetric network. Okay? Eigenvector, the eigenvector of each matrix.
The betas
are
the weights?
No, these betas are the weights. So betas are the columns in this matrix L. Okay. The eigenvectors of L should have eigenvalue of 1. You're right. But that doesn't tell you what the betas should be. Yeah, I think I know where you're heading. And to answer this, betas could be left eigenvectors of L. They don't have to be, but they could be. Okay? Can you reformulate the question?
So you write one feature vector as a combination of these betas, and then what if you
You mean that that if two neurons fire so closely in time that their EPSP cross each other?
Yeah, so for one, when you substitute one basis into the next one, so would
you... I'm not seeing a problem there. I think that because once the spike is fired, EPSP is all set to go. Even if the postsynaptic neuron fires shortly after that, EPSP would either be contributing to that spike or would still be in dendrites and could still recharge the neuron.
So then you talk about the same, about exactly the same, representing one feature as part of
the cell. There is a recurrent activity here. So a neuron ships out its contribution to the percept, and then a fraction of it comes back, yes. It's all, you know, sloshing around all the time. Yeah.
That, if that is equal to the weights, it's very similar to the neurons that fire together, wire together worldview. But the fact that it's not proportional but equal is the same as whether you oppose or not.
Yes, it's not. It does not contradict Hebbian kinds of rules, but I think it imposes a certain requirement on how they should be renormalized.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. That effectively is the normalization that you normally have to put in by hand. It's a normalization that makes this, I think you live in this illusion space on the surface. Right?
Yeah, but remember, this is also postsynaptic. It's very unusual to normalize synaptic weights, postsynaptic weights rather than pre. So that's a very unusual feature.
But it also gives a normalization, not the pre, but
the part of the test. Okay, it depends what you call normalization. We'll just, in the next slide, I think it might answer your question.
Sorry. Representing this little square on the left as firing with, say, amplitude A1 or another potential A1 of cell with left equal receptor. Is that
yes? Yes.
And so, therefore, the dynamics is that so I can start off the system with your four cells active, and then the activity will spread over.
Yes.
So do I have to worry about multiplying numbers of a smaller one, a bigger one, and spreading over exponentially over the number of cells participating in studying?
Yes.
Yeah,
that's a very good question. So I think to restate it slightly differently, this is a linear system of linear differential equations. How do we know that the solution is going to be stable in time? It's not going to explode exponentially or die down to zero. Okay. And what is required for that is that the largest eigenvalue is 1. And I'll show how to get that. That's a very good question. Okay, so this is a family of required networks. If you have this rule, then the percept will be maintained. And now I would like to construct a specific required networks, which guarantees that what Boris asked is true, that the largest eigenvalue is at 1 and the activity does not explode in time. And the way we did that actually came at it in a circumvent fashion, but we've been working on very long time on optimization and resource constraints on synapses and axons and dendrites. And one particular result there that has been measured previously, but I think this is the largest data set that has been measured so far, from about 1,000 synapses reconstructed by electron microscopy. We plot out the spine head volume and the PSD area, and the distribution has an exponential tail. So the probability to find a synapse, a large synapse, is exponentially small in its size. Why is that important? Well, that's because it has been known for a while, and perhaps this is the most direct measurement, which is connected with physiology, that synaptic size actually relates to its weight or efficacy. And we can just assume for now that it's a linear dependence, even though there is a spread. So then what we see experimentally is that the probability to find a stronger synapse decays exponentially. And what that suggested to us is that there is a cost to having large synaptic weights. And that cost, we think, is linear in synaptic weight. As a physicist, you might think of it as deriving a maximum entropy distribution of synaptic weights under, say, this constraint, or with a Lagrange multiplier term like this. So that's what motivated us to say that we want a refire network where each neuron's postsynaptic weight satisfies this condition, plus the total synaptic weight in that network is the minimum possible. And that's what we did. It is computationally a little bit involved. I can explain to you the details of the algorithm after the talk, but right now there are very efficient tools that have been built up in computer science that allow you to solve, to minimize this objective functions, where the first term minimizes the error of the synaptic representation when you represent one neuron's feature vector in terms of the others, and betas are your weights. And the second term maintains that the total synaptic weight is as small as possible. And so for every neuron, we solve this equation and find betas, the smallest possible or the sparsest possible set of betas that that satisfy the refire condition. Okay, depends on which level. Of course, I cannot derive it. The reason linear is great because on the one hand, it induces sparseness. On the other hand, it's convex. There is no other function that would give you that. Right, but yeah, but what did, what kind of level did you want? No, but oh, but that, it's just the volume. That's the whole point. If you have a finite volume, and volume, synaptic volume is proportional to weight, then you have to constrain the total synaptic volume, which is the total synaptic weight. The equations are decoupled. So we can minimize them for each neuron individually, because this is just a constraint on outgoing synaptic weights. Yeah. Well, yeah. So it does look like a quadratic problem, quadratic programming problem, but on the scale that we are interested in solving it with, you know, tens of thousands of betas, old quadratic programming solvers would not do well. But it turns out that this kind of optimization problem has caused so much excitement in computer science in the last 5 to 10 years that they have literally dozens of solvers that do this very, very efficiently. We favor this one called SPAMS, but there are many other alternatives. So once we did this for every neuron and for the receptive fields that we took from Olshausen and field kind of learning algorithm, which was trained on natural images, and I can tell you after the talk in the questions period how the Olshausen and field works, but it doesn't really matter for what I'm going to say. You have a set, I think there are about 300 different receptive fields that were look like experimental ones, but they were produced computationally by training on natural image data sets. And then we, for each of those feature vectors, we express it in terms of others and find the sparsest decomposition and make this network. I could not plot the whole network for you because it would be too cluttered. So we left only 10% of the strongest weights. Yeah, I'm going to go over that. I'll show that in a second. Yeah, so what I have in mind is here is either linear neurons or integrate and fire net neurons. If there is something more complicated, then I would need to think before answering this question.
What is the meaning of X and Y in that graph there?
X and Y, I don't see X and Y. Oh, how is this laid out?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, so this network is laid out using the Laplacian eigenmap. So the neurons whose receptive fields are more similar to each other are more likely to be connected, and then you think of those connections as rubber bands pulling them together. And then there is a force that kind of spreads everything so it doesn't collapse into one point. So it's expected that similar receptive fields are going to be clustered together. And if you think about the wiring economy, then this would also model how they are likely to be distributed in the cortex. If you look very carefully, you will see a pinwheel in the middle. But I really don't want to go in that direction right now. No, there is no reason. We just, you can, for all I know, you could use random feature vectors. You would still get something. But because we are thinking about modeling V1, we wanted to use something that is certifiably like V1. Okay. We didn't look at the spatial connectivity, yes. Okay? So that's the network, and just one thing, that connections are both excitatory and inhibitory. The network obviously does not satisfy Dale rule, so each neuron has outgoing excitatory and inhibitory connections. But I don't think this is a big deal, because you can think about the negative connections as disynaptic connections through inhibitory neurons. And by now, Shaul has modeled that network as well, so we have a network that effectively satisfies the Dale rule. We just didn't want to do it this way because we didn't know how to model inhibitory neurons' receptive fields. But if we were told, we could put that in. Okay, well, then it was good that we did not model them explicitly. Yeah. All right. So just to show that the network works as advertised, here is a simulation. We present this patch to the network, decompose it among neurons' receptive fields. That's the initial activity stage. We let dynamics run for a while. Activity of some neurons go up and down, but the percept, of course, remains constant. There is no space. The way this network was constructed is that for any activity vector, there is a corresponding stimulus. And that corresponding stimulus is not going to change with dynamics.
Where is that?
It's in the synaptic weights that maintain the feature vectors. Mathematically, it's if you represent the stimulus as some sort of dictionary of weights times the activity vector. So this is a vector, this is a vector, this is a matrix, okay? Then what is required is that D equals DL, where L is the synaptic connectivity matrix. And if you satisfy that, I can show you in two lines that for any activity vector, the percept will stay the same. Yep. Yes.
You basically impose the constraint, you throw everything's constraint, and then you define a manifold, and you can play it like you want that manifold. But the question is, what if the manifold gets a little wiggly and
So yes, this is a linear model, and I ask you to stick with the linear model for two more slides, and then I will show you how to make it nonlinear. It's not, V1 is not a common place to look for persistent activity, but there is a paper. There are papers, and actually most recently there is a paper from Singer and Maas saying that there is a memory stain in V1 for hundreds of milliseconds. Whether you believe it or not, is... could be. I'm not calling it as a supporting evidence. What I'm saying is that yes, V1 is not a standard place to look for persistent activity, but I'm not talking about persistent activity, I'm talking about persistent percepts. So you have to analyze your data differently. And the second thing is that I think that if you want to maintain anything for longer than the time to the first spike, which is of order of 1 millisecond, you would have to have that condition. So it's just a matter of time scales. Yes, if you want to store something for multiple seconds, V1 is not the place to do it. But I think that for a function of V1, you want to store it for at least 10 to 100 milliseconds. And then you need something like that. That's a good point. The way it's defined the way the receptive field is defined is by the feed-forward connectivity, not by what would be produced if you did reverse correlation. Yeah, that's a good point. You know, what is this network good for? And yes, I don't have a specific computation that this network can perform, but I think what it gives you, it's a platform to perform computations. Because while the percept stays constant, activity can do whatever it wants, and that's where you can do computation. But then the percept is not destroyed while you're doing that computation. And that's what I think is happening. Of course, I don't have the computation, so it's like giving you an operating system without any of the cool applications, right? So it's like in the Linux operating system, but no, you cannot do email in it yet.
So the computation stays within the network?
That's the idea. That's the idea. Well, it's an integrator, so as things come in, it integrates. Yeah. Wait. I think I have 20 minutes.
Posing a question that makes you go on.
Don't I have 20 minutes that are total up to me? There was a question. So overcomplete representations are generally used in engineering to combat noise. And I think that's probably what they do as well. But I think that there is an additional computational role that can be played here. No. No, because the percept stays exactly the same. Empirically? Oh, we put in usually 2 to 4 times over complete. We don't know how over complete the brain really is. Because, yeah, we can count neurons, but then should we just restrict ourselves to layer 4, layer 2, 3? It's very hard to answer this question because computationally, this becomes difficult once you go to big or to large overcompleteness. And actually, Tao has been doing some of those calculations, and now you know he can give you the details. Yeah, it's a cost balance, right? The more overcomplete the network is, the sparser the activity can be, but then you're paying fixed costs for maintaining those neurons. Exactly. And in fact, Shaul simulated the dynamics of this network in response to a video sequence. And its activity changes much more smoothly than you would have it otherwise. Or alternatively, to record from all of them. Yes. Yes.
How do you really make the
By a frame coefficient?
Right.
By a frame coefficient?
Is there a sparse coefficient?
No, not necessarily. You could do it any way you want, but you can just do the one that minimizes L2 norm, then it's not sparse, so you can do the one that minimizes L1 norm. It could be a projection. It's not essential how you start the network. I think in this case, we started with the sparse representation, perhaps. All right. So, but this is what has been put into the network, so it's not surprising it came out just to demonstrate that we did not make a mistake along the way. This is to answer the question about the eigenvalues and eigenvectors. This is the spectrum of this network of 300 neurons, and it looks nothing like a spectrum of a random network would look like. So there's no circle. All the eigenvalues are close to the real axis, although they're not completely real, they're imaginary ones. So of course, a non-normal matrix. But the amazing thing that we actually stumbled on is that you get a large number of eigenvalues at one. And these correspond to the sensory dimensions. So there are, if the dimensions of the sensory space is n, there are n eigenvectors which span the sensory space completely. And so any sensory percept then is maintained for an indefinitely long time. And then all the other eigenvalues, no eigenvalues are beyond 1. All the eigenvalues are below 1, so they decay at different rates. Because it's not normal, they could go up and down, but there is no explosion here, no exponential divergence. That's right. Wij are approximately equal to Wji here. Not exactly. That is, I think, a good explanation for why it is like that, yes. So, I think I did. It's not very strongly non-normal, but maybe we should discuss that in more detail. I would like to learn what the right measure is. So by itself, it does not hallucinate because we put in a condition that the percept stays constant, okay? So just whatever is there stays. Now, if there is some input, that shifts the percept someplace. But it's very easy to put in dynamics if you really want to. You know, you can just say that the percept is very slowly changing rather than stable, and then you get hallucinations. Integrate. This is a perfect integrator. Well, you can always put a decay term. All right, so how did we get this? I mean, this is really unexpected, and I don't know actually of a literature that said that this is the case. But we don't understand it on the level of mathematical proof. Intuitively, we had this term which minimizes the absolute values of synaptic weights. And that's what we minimized, right? But that is exactly the term that goes into the Gersh-Gorin's theorem, which determines the radius of Gersh-Gorin circles, which should contain eigenvalues. And so what we effectively did without actually knowing it, we tried to shrink Gersh-Gorin circles towards the origin. But because of this condition on the persistency of the percept, we actually require that many of the eigenvalues should be 1. And that's what pins Gersh-Gorin circles at 1. And so the eigenvalues are not pushed below 1. So I think intuitively it's what Gershgorin says, but I think there could be a more powerful mathematical result that would actually make this more formal.
It seems like a perfect solution to your axiom at the beginning has to have dimension at the end, and therefore all of it would be the end.
Yeah. But it happened by a miracle. We started with the synoptic economy. And we minimized the combination of those two terms. And then we actually got the eigenvalue at 1. But that just says that there should be many eigenvalues at 1. It doesn't tell you that there shouldn't be any other eigenvalues greater than 1. That's the minimization. And I'm thinking about it from the Gershgorin circle point of view, but maybe there is a more powerful mathematical result, I don't know.
What do you think you would change if you replaced the minimization
with a fixed total sum of weights?
That's what it is.
Oh. Well, I mean, on the level of Lagrange multipliers, this is interchangeable, yeah. Yeah, I think that's what Richard asked. Not exactly. But I don't have to do that, right? Because feature vectors are not the same thing as receptive fields. Yeah, but no, I my guess is that they wouldn't be distinguishable based on experimental evidence. Yeah, but that would that agree with anatomy? I don't know. Okay, so this is all very nice, but as has been pointed out by Boris, that this is all linear. So can we make it nonlinear? And in some way we can. So here are the nonlinear equations. So again, the percept is S. We represent it with the dictionary of feature vectors times activity vector A. And then the dynamics of A is given by this linear differential equation, okay, where L is just the synaptic connectivity matrix, and I is the identity matrix, which is the decay term, or the spike-intercept term. Okay, where is the nonlinearity? The nonlinearity is how the spiking is related to the internal activity A. And you can put anything you want in there. You can put a spike, you can put a nonlinearity, anything you would put there that relates internal activity to the spiking would work because if you compute the derivative of the percept by using equation 1 and then substitute in equation 2, this operator is in the null space of D. So that tells you that the only thing is required is that the summation of postsynaptic currents in dendrites is linear. What you do with that current after that does not matter. Could be totally nonlinear. And then you ship it out to other neurons, and you want to satisfy the refire condition, and that's the condition on L that we talked about. I don't know. I think there is an experimental question here, which is, We need to record from many neurons at once to answer questions of this sort. Otherwise, I don't know what. The second one. Yeah. Depending on which model you have in mind, either that or reset. Yes. Yeah. Yes. No. The summation of synaptic input is handled separately from the transformation. No. This equation has to be completely linear. The second one has to be completely linear. The nonlinearity can enter only the third equation. Well, yes, but it's just a vector. It's a time-dependent vector.
And I guess there is another issue with the you still have to read out S at the end of the day. And if I say that the readout is F,
yeah, so if I use this assumption that the percept is related to subthreshold activity, which seemed natural for us to make this work, then there is an issue with readout. I agree. But I'm not troubled by that as much because I don't think you need to read out everything, right? That's the homunculus fallacy, right? That you, but you don't need to communicate the whole percept. You just need to communicate some compressed part of that percept to V2. That's what that activity dynamics does. That's exactly the computation that is being done in a percept invariant way. I know this sounds counterintuitive, but this is just seemed natural to get the whole thing to work. So, you know, since we don't really have evidence against it, maybe even be true. All right, so maybe I should round up. So there is also a lot of dynamical properties that have been known in the community for a very long time, and we just checked it on the network by running integrate and fire neurons, and it passes all those tests just fine. So, just in terms of like proving that this network has anything to do with reality, not just a theoretical construct, of course, eventually, we would like to do the complete EM reconstruction following mapping of synaptic fields, and Clay is busy working on that. So that would really test this hypothesis conclusively. What?
And a few others.
And a few others, yes. And so far, we don't have that conclusive test, so we only have some snippets of statistical measures. And they all seem to agree with the network. So the distribution of connection weights, of course, we put in that linear cost term. So it's not surprising that we get exponential decay. But what is also neat is that we get a large delta function at zero. So we have a very sparse connectivity. That's, of course, what is known in the cortex. Now, the sparseness in our model network is about 9%. So if you pick a random pair of neurons, with probability 9%, there will be a synapse from A to B. The rest will just have zero weights. Then if this was a completely random connectivity, you would expect a probability of reciprocal connection to be 1%. Instead, it's 3%. And that's, of course, because correlated receptive fields are more likely to be connected, and then they're used in representing each other. And that, of course, agrees with what is measured. By all means. By all means. You could... To the degree that we looked at it, we could not vary it very much. But I have to admit that we're still a little bit limited by our computational ability to build larger networks. So this is 300 neuron networks. If you build a 10 times over complete network, maybe something will change. But so far, so good. So that seems to work. When we look at triplet statistics, we get something very similar to what has been measured experimentally, although not identical motif fingerprints, but generally the idea that triplets where each pair of neurons is connected one way or another, overrepresented, is reproduced in our network. To get to a more functional measure, we looked at the probability of connection as a function of the orientation preference between neurons. And so we plotted the probability of two neurons being connected as a function of their orientation preference difference. And indeed, connected pairs are more likely to have similar orientation preference rather than orthogonal. But the interesting observation is even orthogonally oriented receptive fields have a finite probability of being connected. And although that hasn't been measured directly, there is an indirect measurement that seems to support this by injecting markers into a known place on the orientation map, and then measuring the distribution of axonal boutons that project from that point. These fellows mapped out the probability of boutons present in the orientational column with difference, and as you can see, this shape is similar to that shape. So at least it is consistent with such an indirect measurement. So of course, in the end, the way we want to test it is to do electron microscopy reconstruction, and in the interest of time, I'll just skip that part. I'll just say that at Genelia, we now have a functioning complete pipeline that is semi-automated and produces reconstructions of circuitry. And the biggest volume that we're working on now is about 12 by 12 by 50 microns. So it's a little small for the cortex, but we're reconstructing. We're reconstructing fly circuits. Really wants to go to the summary, but I want to show the fly vision circuits that we're doing. I'm sorry? Yeah, but it's a technique week, so I thought that, you know, I should I should justify my presence here. So these are neurons in the fly visual, in the fly optic lobe, in the medulla, actually. The reason they're interesting is because these are neurons that do motion detection. So this is the Reichert elementary motion detector. And we haven't completed this work yet, and we haven't completely mopped out the circuit, but our suspicion is that it's not a Reichert detector. So to summarize the talk, the first idea I wanted to communicate that we really have to think, well, I really had to think how I thought about how dimensional representations, because in the brain they're not orthogonal, it's not a basis, it's a frame. And if you decouple a representation from the activity, then you can use activity to do some interesting things like computations while keeping the percept the same. We can construct neural networks that we call refire, which actually maintain the percept while the activity goes through some non-trivial dynamics, basically any dynamics you might want. as long as the percept is the same. And when we build such a refire network, except that we try to make the sparsest connected refire network, and looked at its statistical properties, it looks really, really similar to what we know about the real cortex, which what justifies me spending an hour and a half of your time to tell you about this. And finally, I think we need to conclusively test this hypothesis by combined receptive field mapping with circuit reconstruction. So the reconstruction project is big part of my life and other people's. A lot of other people are involved in this. And the theory part is something that requires fewer people. And this particular work was done very closely with Shaul Druckmann, who will be here too next week, and other people in the group also helped with different aspects of this. And this is Ginelli. Thank you very much.
If I followed all that correctly, it seems like you have a hypothesis for solving the problem of persistence that depends on having a whole lot of synaptic weights be constrained in very particular ways. And what do you imagine the biology of fine-tuning, adjusting those weights to support that kind of functionality?
Well, you can have learning rules that do that.
Learning homeostasis, all these things we
normally Yeah, I mean, an essential part of this that, of course, you need to do this renormalization on the postsynaptic side. But it's not that far from, you know, traditionally accepted Hebbian rules.
So, you know, maybe, you know, to oversimplify, the coefficients are off in a way that wouldn't support that persistence, the system would punish itself by having too much activity.
Yeah. Exactly.
But you haven't specifically thought through those.
Not in a very detailed fashion. We did something that sort of looked quasi plausible, but we haven't had time to explore that direction. So if I understood your question correctly, how is it possible that, you know, you're facing this stream, video stream coming at you, but I'm requiring the percept to stay constant in your brain? Why doesn't it collide? Yes. Yeah. So what the network that I'm presenting to you is a perfect integrator. So if you did the differentiation in the retina, for example, which is sort of what on and off cells do, then you would produce differentials that will shift the cortical representation in different directions. And so if there is a signal to change the percept from the retina, then you will adjust your population vector to accommodate this. What this network lets you do is to adjust that vector very, very easily. So even though, you know, the number of thalamic synapses is very small compared to the internal synapses, they don't need to work that hard because any movement in the stimulus plane does not require any force. It's like an attractor, a line attractor, except it's a subspace attractor. So you can shift it very easily. But if there is no input coming in, it will store the percept forever.
So
Yeah, I think that more data is better, so I need to look up that paper, obviously. But I think this kind of suggestion really emphasizes recording from large number of neurons. I mean, you can certainly, you could be able to disprove this hypothesis. For example, just like those statistical measurements, they didn't have to agree. So you could find something in the limited recording that disproves it. So it is the theory is falsifiable without recording from all the neurons. But I'm not sure how you would prove that it's right without doing. Yes.
So they should all be really close together, and because in order to read it out, then some other neuron has to know exactly who to hook to get the
yeah.
output, right? So they should be modules someplace.
Yeah.
They shouldn't just be spread all over the place. Right.
Yes, I mean, what I'm thinking, when we are simulating this network of 300 neurons, these are neurons with different orientations and spatial frequency, but they will all belong to one column in V1 because they have an overlapping receptive field.
So you wouldn't have to record from all the neurons in a big area.
Oh, yeah.
Any place where one of these modules was keeping persistent behavior, you ought to be able to.
Yes.
And you'd see them all close together, all firing.
Yeah.
With a constant amount of light coming out of that one area.
You see it?
Yeah, but it kind of relates to stuff that I grew up with in the visual cortex, which is very similar with some obvious differences. And there are decades of models where there's feed forward and then recurrence, which essentially amplifies or reinforces the feed forward. And those models tend to need inhibition to keep the lid on, et cetera, et cetera.
Yep.
And this seems to be almost identical, except that it's literally a singular or a degenerate. It has the degeneracy
exactly.
built in by hand.
Exactly.
Because you need to get to a place where the eigenvalues are all near one. And I'm trying to figure out how different the models are and what are the predictions from your precondition that things last forever and exactly forever, and the other classes of models that are just merely reinforcing models with normalization to keep them going on.
Yeah, I think this is consistent with the general body of knowledge in visual neuroscience. What was most difficult for me personally was to realize that this restriction on synaptic weights is done postsynaptically, right? So this is outgoing synapses in the neuron. And I've never seen anything like that in visual neuroscience. Usually people think about the incoming synapses, and so did I. And that's why it was so hard to switch. I was thinking for the longest time that I'm just dealing with transposed connectivity matrices and I'm just making some stupid mistake.
And the biggest differences among many other apps that you see are reproducing the spectrum. Weights and also the song results, the higher order motifs have a certain spectrum and you get that somehow for free independent surrogate.
Approximately, approximately. And the orientational selectivity of connections.
Right.
So those things kind of fall out for free. Which model? Oh, okay.
What is it? Why is long times should come along with this recurrence exaltation? And you are building zillions of long times.
Yeah.
That would be a way to tell the public to your own.
Well,
I think it's a matter of time scale, you know, because once we have this persistence, then we can kill it with anything. So I think this is actually what happens on the short time scales, and what Miller or what Suri and Haim or Goldman said would happen on a longer time scale. So that's what this will flow into. Yes.
It would be a little hard to kill. You aren't killing all the cells at once, because if you just killed it one, the other, the rest of the cells would just keep remaining, right?
I spent so much time trying to keep it alive. I haven't had time to think about how to kill it.
Not the whole module, all the cells in the module, otherwise the other ones would just.
Well, okay. So there is a big question in the persistent activity community is to how to fine-tune the parameters to keep the persistency constant, so to have those eigenvalues exactly at one. And I hope I didn't give you an impression that we solved that problem. Our network is subject to that same problem, just like the persistent activity networks are. So there is still, you can still keep asking this fine-tuning questions, and we don't have an answer, just like the persistent activity people don't. So in that sense, you know, it will be destroyed.
Okay, thanks. Thank you.